With help from his two companions, the stork staggered out through Palmeras Town's northeastern gate and down the open road toward Chapelabel, the seat of Abelican power. A strange and unexpected feeling washed over Branson at that moment. Suddenly, it seemed real to him, this search for Brother Bran Denard, his father. No, not his father, he decided, for that honor remained with Garibald. To this point, Branson had considered this journey north a diversion as much as anything else, a delay against facing the hard truth of his road south. He had latched on to the idea of finding his father as much so that he wouldn't yet have to face the Gestetu mystics and their answers, or, more pointedly, their possible lack of answers, as out of any real desire to find and know the man who had sired him. Now, though, with the road straight and clear before him and the last real city left behind, the idea of finding Brother Denard suddenly seemed very real. And Branson wasn't even sure what that meant. Would the man acknowledge him? Would the man crush him tight in a hug and be overcome with joy that his son had found him? Did Branson even want that? What might such a joyful reunion mean to the memory of his beloved Garibald? So many questions swirled in Branson's thoughts the moment that road came clear to him, the moment the idea of finding Brother Denard became real to him. Questions of how he might react to the man, of how the man might react to him, and most of all, as time and wobbly steps passed, of why. Why hadn't Brother Denard returned for him? Brother Honig Brisbolas rambled through the streets of the lower city. Honig's news would prove important, critical even. A few minutes later, Brother Brisbolas burst into Father Malskinna's private chambers.
What is it, Brother Honig? Did you meet with Captain Trevane?
They raised sail!
A perplexed Father Malskinna stared at him for a moment before rising from his desk and moving to a window that overlooked the river. As soon as he glanced out, he saw the truth of it as all three privateers had set their sails up and engaged.
What is the meaning?
Trevane makes for the Gulf and beyond.
But Laird Delwall's soldiers and supplies have not even yet arrived.
She will not wait. She laughed at my protests.
Laughed?
She was paid, Father. Well paid. A better offer, she said.
Ethelbert? Here?
No. Captain Trevane teased and would not say, other than to assure that it was not Ethelbert, nor any agent of the foul Laird of Entel. A privateer, she called him. This man who brought her treasure beyond Laird Delaval's offerings.
A third party in the mix of this war?
A thorn, more likely. She said that he moved as a shadow and worked his blade with the skill of a master. A most magnificent blade, she assured me. A blade unlike any she had ever seen, and one she promised that would lay low a laird or would-be king.
The man from Pride Holding.
Malskinna flipped through some notes on his desk and then finally picked one up. It was the note informing him that Laird Priday had been killed by this desperate fellow, who had then set out on the open road, destination unknown. Flipping through some of the back parchments, the father of the Chapel of Precious Memories found the letter of detail sent by Brother Riandu on behalf of Father Jarrick of Chapel Pride.
Branson Garibald, of Pride Town. It is rumored that he was connected to Brother Denard and an exotic woman of Bear.
Denard?
An insignificant brother. He traveled to Bear and was there corrupted by the seductive ways of the beastly barbarians. Father Jarrick properly dispatched him to Chapel Abel to see if his soul could be salvaged.
Yes. Yes, killed on the road, if I recall.
That was the rumor. I know not if Chapel Abel ever confirmed it or not.
We must tell Laird Panlamaris of this.
At once. Have him send word far and wide to beware of this creature, and tell him to look for a damaged and small man.
Damaged?
Malskinna shrugged as he read through the description of Branson, of his stork-like gait and his drooling and stuttering.
An alter ego, a disguise of weakness, it would seem.
Your pardon, Father.
Father Malskinna looked over to see Brother Fartus poking his head in.
I could not help but overhear.
Come in, Brother Fartus. We are discussing a potential problem that has come to Palmeras Town. You have noticed the privateers lifting their sails to the wind?
And that is why I have come, Father. What did I hear regarding a disguise?
Father Malskinna handed over the letter of detail from Brother Riandu.
Go to Laird Panlamaris, tell him everything, and warn him to alert his guards of this stork-like person.
I've seen him. This man, Branson. I saw him only yesterday. I tended him with a soul stone, though to little effect, and bade him come to us this very night before Parvispus.
The creature described in that letter?
Perfectly described. He was named as a hero of the war, and so I went to him generously, as per your commandments on this regard.
It is true, then. The highwayman has come to Palmaris Town.
The highwayman?
A rogue of unusual talent and troublesome ways, it would seem. It was he who paid the privateers to sail from us by their own admission.
Why would they divulge such information?
Captain Chivane freely told me. I went out to her this morning as arranged to tend to her crew. They were already readying for sail, and when I inquired, she told me. Indeed, I would say she was rather proud of her gain, proud enough to rattle a bag of coins and jewels before me and to tell me of her unexpected benefactor.
Let us hope this Branson, this highwayman, feels secure enough in his disguise to take you up on your offer of appearing before us. If so, we will take him quickly and with as little excitement as possible.
Brother Riandu, speaking for Father Jerick of Chapel Pride, takes pains to find kind words for this rogue.
Laird Delaval would not likely see things in that manner, nor will Laird Panlamaris, who will face the wrath of Laird Delaval for allowing the ships of Bergenbel to sail unladen with Delaval's men and supplies. Find this man if he remains within Palmaris Town, and if he does not, find out where he went. Perhaps if we offer him to Laird Panlamaris, that he might offer him to Laird Delaval, our failures will be forgiven.
Branson didn't show up at the Chapel of Precious Memories before Parvespers that night, of course, and indeed, word came back to Father Malskinner even before the twilight ceremony that the man and his two female companions had exited the city through the northern gate on the road to the central highlands, where lay Chapel Abel. The next morning, Brother Fatus rode out the same gate, spurring his horse to the east with all speed to deliver Father Malskinner's warning to the brothers of Chapel Abel. So hasty was Fatus's ride that he didn't stop to inquire about the curious highwaymen at the scattered farmhouses he passed, and so it was on his second morning out that as he rode hard down the lane past a small barn, three sets of eyes stared out at him.
The one who tried to heal you with the gemstones.
He rides as if Powrys are chasing him.
Powrys? Or the highwaymen?
Every day's one and the same.
McQuiggick dipped his paddle into the water beside the small craft.
Weren't for the changes in the damned moon, we not know that the time's passing.
Yach, but she's passing. Feeling it in me bones, I be.
And meself in me broken nose.
McQuiggick brought his hand up to touch his flat, wide nose. A bit flatter and wider still from the smash he'd been dealt 28 days earlier. He had put a piece of white, gummy sap from the small, wide-leaf trees common to the islands across the bridge of his nose to secure it while it healed. He hadn't worn that gum bandage for a few days, but had put it back on just before the scheduled return to Chapel Isle. Pragonag and the others understood the reminder to be for Pragonag's benefit.
Are you to babble all the way, then?
Pragonag was sitting in the back, testing the balance of his wooden-handled metal-bladed hatchet, one of the very few implements of metal still left intact after a century on the steamy lake.
You're to let the whole of Mithrandadu know her about, and it won't it be the kitten's mule to be chased by a fleet of barbarian longboats.
Ah, all we've since have gone to bed.
Would you say what for ourselves?
Bah, we should have built ourselves a barrow boat.
McQuiggick referred to the open sea Powry craft, which resembled huge casks and kept most of their bulk beneath the surface. The interior of a barrel boat consisted of a series of benches set before pedals, and the tireless dwarves propelled their craft by pumping legs, with the pedals geared to turn an aft screw.
Put her out on the lake, and wouldn't that make all the men shiver?
You can't be thinking it. You might be making the trolls happy, but you'd be starting the war for winning and not just for playing, don't you doubt?
Aye, you send a barbarian boat to the bottom and give her crew to the trolls, and all the islands would join against us and come a-calling. Our rock red cap ain't that big.
McQuiggick offered an exaggerated nod to show that he wasn't being serious. He knew as well as any the agreed-upon protocols of the islands, and primary among those was the edict that no combatant, not Powry, nor Alpinadorian, nor Abelican alike, would be dropped under deep water. For Mithranodun's opaque gray waters hid terrible things indeed. Great fish and serpents had been spotted often, and the glacial trolls seemed to know immediately whenever someone went under. No one survived Mithranodun's deep waters for long, and the civilized warfare between the islands demanded certain rules of engagement.
I'd be good to feel the screw beneath my feet again, is all. Aye.
Only Bickleburn and McQuiggick among the six on the boat had ever experienced such a thing, or had ever seen the world beyond the banks of this lake. The Bloody Caps had been on Mithranodun for more than a century now, and though their numbers had dwindled a bit, from 80 to 76, they had been fortunate to recover the hearts of almost all of the more than 40 who had been killed. Fallen to trolls and storms and barbarians in the early days, before the silently agreed-upon protocols. The heart was key to an untraditional and magical form of Powry reproduction. Using it, an appropriate mass of stone and the plentiful lava rock of Mithranodun was perfect for the task, and a month of ancient magic in the form of sacred songs, the Powrys could create life itself, giving birth to the fallen dwarf's successor. Not often practiced on the weathered isles where female Powrys were plentiful, sepulchre, as this magical rebirth was called, had kept the strength of the community of Powrys on the lake, though they had but three females remaining among the lot of them. For sepulchre, for some reason that no dwarf had ever figured out, almost always led to a male child, whether the hosting heart had come from a male or female. Returning from their last trip to Chapel Isle, they had prepared and buried Regwegno's heart and some rock and begun the process. This very afternoon, right before they had departed, they had felt the first rumblings from the sepulchre. The term was also used to describe the physical grave womb. Regwegno's son would climb free 5 months hence, and judging from those initial trembles, all expected this one would prove a scrapper to make his sire proud.
I'm hardly for remembering it, but I've been 105 of me 130 right here on the lake. I make me brother, he Kulnik, paddle out to the ice just so I can feel of cold water. Never thought I'd miss the dark chill of the Mirianic, did I?
Aye.
And I'll be finding it again, is the hope.
McQuiggick, the fool. The land's to be freezing your blood solid inside of you, you dope. You're thinking you're a glacial troll, are you? Well, you're thinking to get yourself dead.
Yach and aye! We're not even for knowing where lies the damned Mirianic. East, say some, but west for others. How many hundreds fell in the march inland? The one the priests call glorious. Weren't for Mithranodun, we'd have all been killed to death.
By the cold, if not the barbarians, if not the monsters.
Bickleburn and McQuiggick exchanged a silent thought then, a slight nod and resigned grin, for they often mused about leaving Mithranodun, and of late had openly wondered how much worse death, even death without sepulchre, could be compared to the tedium of life on the foggy lake.
When the stars come out to shine,
20 boys side to side in a line.
Yeah, but not that one. Tonight's the night for fun, you fools. We're not for war, but for sport.
Sport that's to get Prague's face broken.
Pragonag stared hard at the others and slid his hatchet's metal head along a sharpening stone. The night was dark, so they could hardly see the darker silhouette of Chapel Isle through the mist. They were quite familiar with their approach, though, and few could navigate as well as Powrys, even when Mithranodun's mist was high enough to almost constantly obscure the stars.
Ah, but it's looking like the monks are ready for a fight.
The dwarf lifted his paddle and pointed it ahead, where, through the drifting mist, a single torch could be seen.
He's there with 50 of his friends in wait, no doubt.
Oh, then it's open hunting and me bray sure to shine all the brighter. Steadying straight to the beach in either case. And if there's a bunch to be found, you be quick in passing that axe, Prag, so we can open them up wide and fast.
Cormac had been out of the chapel for several hours by then. His second torch burned low, and his attention had long since left the unseen water. He sat in the sand, his back against a stone, staring up at the stars, which peeked out every now and then through the gray swirl. He worked two gemstones, a soul stone and a lodestone, through his fingers. The lodestone's power lay in magnetism, and Cormac had often come out with it, using its magical properties to look through it at the beach and shallows surrounding Chapel Isle. He had found many coins and old weapons and tools, for with the lodestone he could sense metal. He could even use the power of the stone to telekinesis small metallic objects to his waiting hand. He hadn't found anything this night, but he hadn't really looked, using the lodestone as a pretense for getting out of the chapel without drawing suspicion. Once out here, the sun setting, he lost any interest in even pretending to search, as one question dominated his every thought. Would the Powrys come? Even the pressing thought of impending battle had been lost to him soon after that, as the stars began to shine and before the mists climbed high enough to obscure them so greatly. Cormac often lost himself among the celestial lights, letting his mind drift back to his days in Vanguard at Chapel Pelennor and across the gulf in Chapel Abel, the mother abbey of his church. Those had been good and heady days those years ago, full of purpose and meaning. Cormac had charged into Chapel Abel with his eyes wide and his heart open, soaking in every detail, every premise, every tenet, and every hope of Blessed Abel's homily.
Do those ravenous and hopeful fires remain?
Cormac often found himself melancholy these long and arduous days, his love for Chapel Isle and this lake called Mithranadoon long lost. He did not cheer when the next level of the Rock Abbey had been completed, for it was a place that no one other than the brothers and their servants ever attended. He did not feel joy at the sermons of Brother Giavno or Father de Gilb, even when they read from his favorite of Blessed Abel's teachings. The messengers, he knew, could not inspire him. For while Cormac hated neither man, in fact he was quite fond of Giavno, he knew in his heart that they had misinterpreted their purpose here in Alpinador. They had been sent to proselytize, to teach and to convert. Out here, the early hopes for their mission had not come to fruition. The barbarians would not hear their words any longer, and the rift would not mend. To Cormac's thinking, and he knew their neighbors on the lake better than anyone else at Chapel Isle, their failure would never reverse. The fighting would not stop. The barbarian souls would not be saved.
Ah, Mircalla, alas, for you are my last hope.
Cormac moved to toss a pebble out toward the water, for there, coming at him through the uneven mist, loomed the hairy and wrinkled faces of the bloody-capped dwarves.
So you came out? Alone? Well?
Yes, alone. I gave you my word.
You did no such thing, but you didn't argue. But that you think it's your word or counted it as such, says good about you. What a human, I mean. Says you got honor, or says you got no wits about you. Most with humans were thinking the second. Get it done.
Pragnog came forward, weapon waving at the ready.
You know the rules?
No.
Then you do. Pragnog's looking to finish you. So if you lose, expect to lose a lot of your blood. Now for yourself, you beat him down as much as you're wanting. Not a one of us will get in the way. You kill him, you bash his head in, whatever you're thinking to do. And once you've won, Prag's cap is your own to claim.
I ain't for liking that.
You're meaning to kill him. But we're just for giving him your cap.
Me cap's worth more than his life.
Oh, well, then he could just kill you and take the damn thing.
Only way the dog's getting it.
Kraganog charged in, smashing left and right with his club.
Are you fighting or running?
Pragnog roared ahead, swiping wildly and repeatedly, and Cormac could only dodge and dart back.
How long can ye run?
Pragnog came forward in a sudden rush and launched a mighty overhead chop. Cormac leapt and lay straight out, feet first, and caught Pragnog with a double kick about the face and shoulders. Pragnog rolled to his belly and started up, but he had barely made it to his knees before Cormac fell over him. Cormac rolled about, looping his hands up under the kneeling Powry's arms and up behind the dwarf's neck. Pragnog balled his legs under him and with tremendous strength lifted himself to a standing position, driving the human up behind him. Pragnog went into a sudden frenzy, spinning about left, then back fast to the right, then back and back again. Cormac felt as if he were riding a bull. His feet were off the ground more than not, and so he could do little to interrupt Pragnog when the dwarf took up a sudden run. Cormac understood the intent and saw the cluster of large rocks fast approaching, but Pragnog slapped his arms in a cross up high in his chest, reaching back behind his shoulders to grab Cormac's wrists and hold them fast. Then, with sheer powery power, Pragnog ducked again and launched himself into a somersault, bringing poor Cormac right over the top. Cormac hit the side of the largest rock, and Pragnog sandwiched into Cormac. The club flashed in. Cormac snapped his left forearm up vertically to intercept that blow. The crack sent a wave of nauseating agony ripping through him, but his trained muscles continued the practiced move. He dropped his arm straight down, catching the shaft of the club in his left hand as he twisted about sidelong to his attacker, his right hand knifing up to catch the club right at the Powry's hand. Tugging down with his left and shoving upward with his right, Cormac gained the angle and tore the club from the dwarf's grasp. Cormac stabbed the fat end of the club right into Pragnog's eye. Cormac pursued. Pragnog rolled his shoulder in tight, then burst back out, launching a backhand and one that Cormac would willingly accept. The man curled only a little, bringing his left arm up to again absorb most of the blow, thinking to come in right behind it with another smash of the club, but he didn't absorb it. An explosion of fire ripped through Cormac's arm. He staggered backward, dropping the club and grabbing at his torn skin. He hardly understood what had happened until the dwarf faced him directly, the bloody axe swinging easily at the end of his left arm.
Ah! What?
Pragnog approached, and Cormac dropped his hands and all pretense of defense, for how with his flesh might he stop the swing of a metal-bladed axe?
I'm for wetting me own cat first!
Pragnog brought his axe up high and stepped in behind the descending blow, driving it down with enough force to sever the man's arm if he had lifted it to block. And, indeed, Cormac did lift his right hand, for when he had dropped his arm down beside him, he had brushed against the small belt pouch. Now he held the lodestone, and he saw the metallic axe head through its magic as clearly as if he were looking at the noontime sun on a cloudless and mistless day. He sent his energy into the gemstone, bringing its magic to an immediate crescendo. When Cormac opened his hand, the charged lodestone bulleted out with tremendous speed, firing true to the call of the metal axe head. Good fortune was with Cormac, for the gemstone hit the axe as it descended past Pragnog's head, and the force of the blow broke the head from the handle so cleanly that it flew back into the dwarf's ugly face. The stone flew away, far, far away, and Pragnog staggered back, a crease of blood showing about his cheeks and nose. Cormac grasped his torn arm again and stumbled over to straddle the dwarf. He reached down and pulled the dwarf's beret free, then grabbed a clump of Pragnog's hair and tugged his head up out of the dirt.
I'm not knowing what just happened.
You said I knew the rules.
And still, Pragnog showed no signs of resistance or consciousness.
Do you mean to kill him to death then?
Cormac looked down at the mass of hair and blood, then simply let go. The man stepped away, and a pair of Powrys went to their fallen comrade, unceremoniously hoisting him to his feet.
Yar, what in the dark wars?
What? He put your gob in the head, you dope. He put you down good.
I'll be paying him back.
No, you'll be shutting your mouth and making yourself another cop.
Pragnag yanked one arm free from the dwarf holding him, and when that fellow tried to grab him again, Pragnag slammed the back of his fist into the dwarf's eye.
No, you don't!
You got your bum beat, and your cat's the price!
It is all right.
The Dactyl Demon it is!
The human keeps his word coming out, but yourself's not got that honor!
I hate to give him me cap!
It is all right.
McQuiggy turned sidelong to the advancing Pragnag and lifted his right arm up high and back, holding the cap away. He brought his left arm in against his torso defensively, it seemed.
You give it!
When McQuiggy kept the cap away from his reach, Pragnag slugged the dwarf in the face. McQuiggy had retrieved something else when he had grabbed up the cap, and his left arm shot across neck high to Pragnag.
You be giving it to me!
The sharpened axe head, quietly retrieved by McQuiggy as he walked over, had cut a neat line indeed across poor Prague's throat. McQuiggy stepped back and calmly presented the beret to Cormac. Cormac went for his pouch and his remaining stone.
I can heal him.
McQuiggy stopped him dead in his tracks with an outstretched arm.
No, you can't. You can take your damn cap and dip it in his blood. Then you can put it on your head and get you gone from here. We're done playing, boy. And the next blood what's spilling will be your own.
He thrust the beret into Cormac's hand.
Dip it!
Cormac stumbled off the beach a few thumping heartbeats later, wet cap in hand.
Oh, laddies! Don't forget to be taking old Pragnag's heart now.
The five-man craft drifted through the mist. Andrusis sat forward, his long legs hanging over either side of the prow, which angled up high enough so that Andrusis's feet remained comfortably high above the water. At 18, he was more than 10 years younger than the other Alpinadorians on the boat. Three weathered helmsmen, and the oldest of the group, the shaman, Tonike. No hair remained on Tonike's head, and his light skin was stretched thin with age and dotted with many brown spots, presenting an imposing appearance indeed, as if he had already gone into the grave and returned. The few teeth remaining in his mouth stuck at awkward angles and shined yellow, and the thin mustache he wore seemed no more than a shadow, depending on the light. Another man curled against the aft rail, working the rudder and the sails, and the other two sailors sat in the middle of the 15-foot craft just ahead of Tonike. Each held a paddle across his lap, ready to assist at the command of the navigator. Long lines stretched out behind the boat, each set with a multitude of hooks. The catch had been thin thus far, with only two rather small silver trout thrashing about in the many buckets in the flat hold between Andrusis and the paddlers. The gnarled Canrak worked the rudder.
Too calm a day.
Though he was not an old man, in fact, he was the youngest other than Andrusis, his face was so wrinkled that it seemed as if someone had piled separate slabs of skin one atop the other in the shape of a head. Add to that a thick black beard that grew in places where it shouldn't and didn't grow in other places where it normally would, and Andrusis thought the lean and gangly Canrak possibly the ugliest human being he had ever seen. Quite the opposite of Andrusis, who, with his fair skin and yellow hair, had caught the eye of almost every young woman in Yosemfir. Tall and strong, with wide shoulders and a solid frame, Andrusis also stood out as one of the more promising young warriors among the tribe, and that fact, he knew, had played no small part in Tonike's decision to carry him along on these long fishing excursions.
She is calm and flat this day, but never too much so. Mithranadun is a blessing, storm or still.
Tonike was replying to Canrak, but Andrusis knew that the nasty old shaman had aimed those words his way. Tonike knew well of Andrusis's friendship with Milkela, and he had led the outrage against her those weeks before when she had dared suggest an expedition to the shores beyond Mithranadun. Subsequent to Milkela's bold suggestion, it was no secret that the tribal leaders had purposely carved up the tasks to keep the suspected conspirators apart. In fact, some of those elders, like Tonike, had been boasting of their wisdom quite openly. When the five had boarded the boat this morning, Tonike had whispered to Andrusis,
"This is where you will learn the truth. not in the wandering hopes of a young woman frustrated because she has found no willing lover among her peers.
Andrusus had let the ridiculous insult to Milkela pass without response, something that still weighed on his proud shoulders.
Do you believe that we are wasting our time out here, friend Andrusus?
A time on Mithranadun is never wasted, master.
Well spoken! Do you truly believe that?
Andrusus turned back to regard the man and started to respond, but bit it back, seeing that there was no compromise there, that Tanake was goading him into open admissions that could be used to further split apart the group of young conspirators. So Andrusus said nothing.
Tenderloins!
They've nothing on them.
Bring them in, then. Let us learn if we can waste our time more productively.
Andrusus studied Tanake for a long moment, and still the old and withered man did not blink. Andrusus moved deliberately, finally, past the sloshing trout and between the oarsmen. He purposely focused on the back of the boat as he passed Tanake and methodically began hauling in the lines. Before they were even aboard, Tanake motioned for the two men before him to dip their paddles.
Bring us right, half a turn.
Kanrak nodded and grabbed the rudder, but paused and looked at Tanake curiously.
Half right?
Half right!
Your son here is left and back.
Do you think me too stupid to know that?
No, Elder, but half right.
Half right and bring us straight and open the sail wide to the breeze and paddle, both of you, strong and straight.
We are not that deep.
Kanrak turned directly to Andrusus then and gave a concerned look, but the young man, not nearly as experienced with the ways of Mithranadun, had no response. He kept hauling and tossed one or two sour looks back at Tanake, who had his back to him and paid him no heed at all. This wasn't about fishing, Andrusus now fully understood. Tanake hadn't come out here to secure the day's catch. This trip was about Andrusus, wholly, and about the conspiracy of the young adults who so desperately wanted to get off this smothering lake. Even so, the boat's turn had Andrusus surprised, as it had obviously unnerved the other three. Beside Andrusus, Kanrak licked his lips repeatedly and kept his hand tight on the tiller, obviously anticipating and hoping for Tanake's command to change course yet again. But the shaman didn't make a move or utter a sound, and the small craft glided through the mist. Kanrak's warning that they were not that deep echoed in Andrusus's thoughts. A dark form loomed in the water ahead, and to port, a rock, prodding up like a signpost warning intruders.
Hold it, Tanake.
Andrusus, to the front!
But the line, I...
Leave it, and go forward to watch our dip!
Andrusus scrambled past the old shaman and the two paddlers. He leaned far over, putting his face near the water, trying to get an angle in the light that would give him the best view to gauge the depth. They weren't that shallow at all, he realized, to his relief, though another rock showed off to port, protruding several feet into the air above the water level. He turned back to report such to Tanake and met the shaman's bemused expression, the man pointing past Andrusus, dead ahead. When he looked forward again, Andrusus understood everything. Less than 50 running strides away loomed a dark and foreboding beach, sharply inclined and covered with black, sharp-edged lava rock. Just a short distance up and away from the steaming water, the rock mingled with fingers of ice and snow, creating a stark contrast of white and black, each segment of the mix appearing as hardened as the other. A few scraggly tree skeletons showed among the stones, but they hardly constituted a sign of life, seeming more like a warning, warding away any living thing. The mist blew across Andrusus's field of vision, alternately thick and thin, and in a moment of clarity, he picked out among that desolate landscape a series of caves. He knew this place for what it was then, and he spun on Tanake as if to scream an accusation.
This is the destination of your dreams. This is the promise of the foolish Milkela. Look well upon the desolation.
Too close to the trolls.
The man paddling to Tanake's left quietly lifted his paddle from the water and brought it across his lap. His companion did likewise, and both stared at the shaman eagerly, as if in anticipation of an order that would get them fast away from this dangerous place.
There are many such spots, and you would need to stumble upon just one to be slaughtered. Nay, you would not even have to find one to arrive swiftly at your grave, fool. We are not like our mainland kin. We have lost their ways of survival, as our blood has lost its thickness, as it has thinned from the warmth of blessed Mithranadun. I warn you now, with this fate clear before you, our patience...
Glacial Troll.
As he glanced fast over his shoulder, Andrusus thought he caught some motion near the caves.
Do you understand now, young one? You think this all a game, a play for excitement?
Holy Tonike, we must be gone.
But the paddlers weren't waiting for the order any longer, and by the time the shaman turned back forward, they had already splashed their paddles into the water, the man to the right pulling hard, the one to the left reversing his motion, so that even without Kanrak's work on the tiller, they set the boat into a standing turn.
Mark you well the lesson of this day!
The small boat began to move away from the shore into the safety of the mist. After a few moments, they all began to breathe easier, but then both paddlers jerked suddenly. One nearly went over the side before falling back into the boat, his hands empty, while the other put up a brief tug of war, hauling his paddle in with all his strength, so much so that he lifted the top half of the troll, clutching the other end right out of the water. A moment later, a second troll speared out of the water, rising high into the air like a fish leaping for an insect. With tremendous momentum, it climbed up higher than the sailor holding the paddle, and as it descended, it grabbed him by the collar. Andrusus started for the spot, but stopped and spun about as another troll lifted into the air before the boat, angled to land on the prow. Andrusus timed his heavy punch perfectly, catching the aqua-colored creature square on the jaw as it landed. Then the boat erupted in fighting as one troll after another flew up into the air and crashed down inside the hold. Kanrak and the other sailor flanked Tanake, who held his hands up before him, his eyes closed. A trio of trolls pressed them hard, clawed hands changing strikes against the small knife of the paddler and the gaff hook Kanrak had collected before coming forward. Andrusus rushed back to join his companions, scooping up a water-filled bucket as he passed. He threw that bucket into the face of the nearest troll. Another troll leaped aboard. Andrusus met it with a heavy punch, but this one swung as well, and it carried a club. Fist and weapon came together hard, the barbarian's knuckles shattering under the weight of the blow. Andrusus went forward instinctively, lowering his shoulder to bowl into the creature before it could strike again with a club. Tanake tried hard to shut out the tumult around him and concentrate on the spell casting. He called upon the ancient gods of his people, upon Drawmir of the North Wind, gathering the offered power in his hands as he put them up over his head and began moving them harmoniously in a circle. He opened his eyes and saw a spear stabbing through Kanrak's shoulder and saw too yet another troll leaping high out of the water to the side of the boat. Its trajectory would have brought it crashing against Tanake, but he reacted by thrusting his hands out in the troll's direction, throwing forth the gathered wind. The flying troll looked like it had been flung by a sling. Tanake paid it no more heed, turning his attention to the more immediate fighting and to the sail. The sail. The shaman worked his hands again more quickly and less powerfully this time, and filled the sail with a conjured gust of wind, swiftly driving the boat out toward the deeper water. Andrusus finally got a punch cleanly through, smashing the troll's face, and the back of its head cracked hard against the wooden deck. Andrusus rolled off, seeing that the creature was finished. Kanrak was down, the troll above him stabbing repeatedly with its crude spear. Andrusus shook off the shock and charged back, kicking the troll off Tanake as he passed. He stumbled as he went under the sail, but didn't let that slow him as he threw himself at the spear wielder. The troll managed to extract the spear and angle it so that it caught Andrusus on the right hip as he drove into it. Fires of pain exploded along that hip and down his leg, but again he ignored them, forcing himself to understand the consequences of failure here. He bore the troll to the deck and went into a frenzy. Andrusus turned shakily about just in time to see the troll he had kicked leap up against the sail, thrashing at it with clawed hands. Tanake came in fast behind, too fast, for as he collided against the troll, it thrust forward and the shaman could not halt his momentum. Both he and the troll went through the sail. The remaining paddler was being mauled by a pair of trolls. Tanake turned fast and began waving his arms to summon his magic. but then he lurched and doubled over and grasped at the spear that had hit him in the gut. Andrusus staggered past him, but knew he would not get to his companion in time, and he could only gasp and look on helplessly as the two trolls and the Alpinadorian rolled over the prow and disappeared under the water. Andrusus turned to see that the troll he had smashed had also gone over. He slumped down next to Tanake, saw the spear embedded in the shaman's gut, and had no idea of how he might help the man. A sudden jerk on the boat had him back to his knees, looking aft with concern at the long line he hadn't completely brought in. He crawled to it and peered out to see the paddler bobbing along behind them, apparently caught in the hooks. Andrusus grabbed the line and began hauling the man toward him, but he knew before he got the poor man against the taffrail of the boat that he was too late. He grabbed the man by the shirt and half-hauled him over, but as the man's head lolled back, Andrusus stared into wide-open, lifeless eyes. He lost his grip and fell backward onto the deck and lay staring up at the sky. He stared up, but he only saw blackness.
Perhaps it is because in order to simply survive, I had to remain so much more in tune with the workings of my body, or perhaps it was my Jester 2 training. But whatever the reason, I find that I am more apt than the average person to understand the subtle clues offered to me by my unconscious soul. So many things we reveal to ourselves without ever realizing them. The lightness of my step when I departed Palmaris Town, for example, whether in the guise of the stork or in that of the highwayman, buoyed me. I felt as if I could leap 100 feet off the ground. The hopes of seeing this man, my father, Bran Denard, filtered through my being and lifted my spirit. Consciously, I wasn't even thinking about such things. Consciously, I told myself, berated myself, that this entire journey was no more than procrastination. The real road was south and east, but I was, deliberately, a long way from there. But despite my pangs of guilt, I felt that buoyancy, clearly and acutely, a sense of excitement, and not just because I had successfully deflected and delayed facing my deepest fears. Nay, on this road to the Mother Church of the Abelican Order, I felt as if I was moving forward on my journey, as if I was taking a very important and exciting stride. I wondered if I was betraying Garibald, my beloved father in practice, who had raised me and tolerated my infirmities without complaint, who had loved me without condition and without embarrassment. My road seemed to be leading me to the man who had sired me, and my road was walked with eagerness. So what did that reflect upon Garibald and his sacrifices? And what did I really expect from this man, Bran Denard? And why hadn't he come back for me? More than 2 decades had transpired since his departure from Pride Town, and he had not returned for Sin Wee or for his child. As I ponder these many angles, my mind jumbles and shakes and darts in directions unasked for, and to all of them, I have no true answers, I recognize, for I will not know how I feel about Bran Denard until I have met him. I will not know his answers to my concerns until he has explained them. I will not know the effect upon the legacy of Garibald until long has passed, I am sure. Indeed, that is the most unanswerable question of all, because the truth is clear and yet clouded by guilt that most opaque veils. I loved and still love Garibald with all my heart and soul. I would throw myself upon a pyre of flames to save him without hesitation. I would do anything, anything at all to have him back. Of my sire, I am less certain. Of Bran Denard, I have only expectations with which to guide my preconceptions. Well, only those in the Book of Jest, the tome he penned, or copied at least. For the contents were such that no one without understanding of the book could properly relay its subtle shades. Perhaps that book remains the paradox of my inner conflict, the source of both excitement and trepidation. For I would desperately desire to meet the man who penned that book, that marvelous tome which freed me from my abject helplessness, even if he had no connection to me in blood or otherwise, other than the connection I feel in my heart to that which he wrote. On this level alone, I am truly comfortable with my journey. How could it be otherwise? I desire to meet the man who penned the wondrous book as I desire to meet the mystics of Bear who live the lessons of that book in their daily existence. And this journey is even safer than that, for whatever the outcome of my meeting with Brandonard, the Walk of Clouds remains. Hope remains. Is this then a comfortable step for me? For all of my other fears regarding this stranger, I hold few or no familial expectations, so I suspect that I cannot be disappointed in that matter, and whatever philosophy Brandonard may express now, or whatever he might offer or not offer to further my recovery, he has already given so much to me that I cannot hold my anger against him. Or maybe I do. Perhaps my anger at his refusal or inability to return to Senhui and to me will prove a stronger angst than I anticipate, a thorn more deeply embedded in my heart than I now understand. And so, with a resigned sigh, I must admit it may be that the only real comfort of this journey is that it allows me to put off the even more terrifying march to the Walk of Clouds.
Dawson McKeague stood at the prow of his two-masted coast runner, Lady Dreamer, taking in the grand oceanic and coastline view that never grew old for him. For before the craft loomed a mighty 300-foot granite cliff, and atop it, as if growing right out of the rock, stood Chapel of Bell, the heart of the growing influential church. This was the spot where Blessed Abel had first demonstrated the power of the God-given gemstones. This was the spot where, on guidance from God, it was said, he had learned to make permanent the magical properties of those rocks he had found after being shipwrecked on a distant island in the deep southern Mirianic Ocean. Alone and as removed from civilization as any man had ever been, Abel had had little expectation of surviving and seemingly no chance of ever returning to Hans. But the magical stones had showered down from the heavens, the gifts of God to him, and as he had sorted through their magical properties, this young philosopher had come to understand them fully. With those stones, Abel had walked hundreds of miles across the ocean, so it was said, and through the power and potential of the gemstone magic, he had changed the world. Dawson wasn't yet formally confirmed as an Abelican. He had been raised in Vanguard among a thriving farming and hunting community dominated by the Samhastes, and the old ways died hard. Still, he couldn't deny the spirituality he felt whenever this site, Chapel of Bell, so impressive and growing grander by the day, came into view. Hidden among the cliffs was a dock facility, with tunnels that climbed through the stone all the way to the chapel above. Tunnels reputedly cut by Abel himself, utilizing a variety of potent gemstones.
Hail to the flag of Dame Guaidra!
A pair of monks stood in open view, waving at the approaching ship. Dawson recognized one as Brother Pinaur, and returned the wave with a familiarity and heartiness reminding him that the relationship between Guaidra and his church had grown so very strong. McKeague's ship pulled up alongside the longest of the three wharves, and tenders hopped to the dock to begin securing her. Brother Pinaur met McKeague on the dock.
Weapons, metals, or foodstuffs. You'll be hard-pressed to get any, of course, in this dastardly time.
Lairds Ethelbert and Delaval continue their war, then.
Escalate would be a better word. Laird Delaval believed he'd gained an advantage, and so he strengthened his line across the breadth of it, thinking to push Ethelbert right into the sea. But it wasn't to be. Ethelbert's got a few tricks left, and a few allies from Bear.
A Laird of Hans is using the desert savages?
Desperate folk take desperate measures.
I have a hold full of caribou moss.
Dawson referred to the white moss that climbed knee-deep in regions of Vanguard and was favored for packing open wounds among its many other uses. In a time of war, that particular purpose of the fungus would take precedence, obviously, but extract of dried caribou moss could also be brewed into a medicinal tea, and sheets of the moss often sold at exorbitant prices as roofing or siding material, both practical and decorative, for the fancy homes of wealthy merchants. Vanguard had many profitable trading goods to offer Hans proper, but in this time of war, none was more sought after than the caribou moss.
The lairds will pay well for it.
They will pay Chapel of Bell well, then. For I've no time to cart my wares southeast or southwest. And my boat's back to Vanguard when she puts out from your dock presently, unless I am forced to make a detour to Palmaris Town.
We have some goods, of course. And some coin.
Some? The whispers say that your church grows wealthy on the tributes of warring lords.
Whispers. Come!
Brother Pinhour led him off the wharf and to the gated entrance and the winding tunnels that would carry them up to the clifftop and the mother chapel of the Abelican Church. As soon as he exited that dock tunnel into the courtyard of the abbey, McKeague understood those whispers of growing wealth to be understated. For Chapel of Bell was more than twice the size it had been on his last visit only a year before. Scores of laborers worked the grounds, extending and thickening the already impressive outer wall and constructing new stone structures, barracks and rectories and all manner of buildings. Chapel of Bell had become a town unto itself, McKeague realized, and when he thought about it, it made sense. Once Chapel of Bell had been a small church set on a hill above the medium-sized town of Weathergard, but in this time of pressing danger, it had become a fortress, a welcomed one for the beleaguered folk of the region. Dawson looked to the main church, which was now surrounded by scaffolding, monks swarming every region of it with tools and materials. No layman worked this all-important building, he noted. Its construction remained for the brothers alone.
Father Otto Leven will be pleased to greet you this day. It would help if I could introduce you with your intent.
Tell the good father that I come with value and leave with purpose. For Vanguard's in need of...
He paused there and let the thought hang in the air between them. Indeed, it seemed as if poor Brother Pinhour would fall right over from leaning so obviously toward McKeague. Dawson merely grinned, intensifying the tease. Soon after, Dawson stood before Father Artelivan, an old friend of Dame Guidra, who had secretly offered his blessing to her union with Brother Alandris.
I've come under full sail and will leave the same way.
Always in a hurry.
Artelivan looked every day of his 80 years. Skin sagged about his face, and his eyes had sunk deeply, circled by darkness. He could still sit straight, but not without great effort, Dawson noted, and there remained little sparkle and sharpness in his gaze.
That is the way of the world, I fear. None have time to give pause. Patient consideration is a thing of the lost past.
War breeds urgency, Father.
And what is your urgency?
I've a hold of caribou moss, and no time to barter.
So I've been told of both situations. You seek coin, then, so name your initial offer.
I seek coin only to use it for another good. I will use the coin, and have brought much of my own as well, to bribe.
You have come for able bodies.
Yes.
To harvest, to log, as wives or as laborers.
Yes, all of that. Vanguard is sorely pressed by the Samhaists. Dame Guidra has victory at hand.
We are all sorely pressed, friend Dawson. War rages the breadth of Hans.
Yet I see Chapel of Bell swarmed by laborers. Many young men who have apparently escaped the fighting.
Many who were captured and thus put out of the fight on honor.
From both camps, no doubt.
It made sense, of course, for neither Laird Ethelbert nor Laird Delaval had the time or resources to expend on prisoners of the conflict. Neither wanted to enrage the populace by summarily executing captives, many of whom were likely related to constituents and soldiers on both sides of the conflict. So the respective lairds would demand a vow of honorable capitulation, effectively ensuring that the captured soldiers would not return to their former ranks, and then send them here to the Abelicans to gain the favor of the priests who held the sacred stones. Of course, both leaders, for fear of making honorable capitulation attractive, required the Abelicans to work their laborers brutally and reward them not at all.
I had not heard that the Samhaists were near defeat in Vanguard. Quite the opposite.
They have called upon goblins and trolls to strengthen their lines. We are sorely pressed, yet victory is at hand.
Well, that seems a rather strange interpretation. Three sentences, spoken one following the other, as if the logic of them flowed as such.
Their line cannot hold. If Dame Guidra can counter their latest excursions with a forcible strike, the mishmash of warriors our enemies the Samhastes have assembled will turn upon each other. We have seen it in several regions already. Dame Guidra is certain that a sudden and...
The details of war bore me. From this church, you will be paid in coin alone, at fair value, given the need for caribou moss at this time.
Both armies will value it greatly.
What you do with that coin is for you to decide. The workers here are not free men, but they are many. Indeed, perhaps too many. If some choose to sail with you back to Vanguard, you and I... Nay, you and Brother Pinower will reach a proper sale price.
Dawson grinned and nodded and dared to hope that he could fill his hold with able bodies in short order.